Chapter 30. There is no denying it would have been more fortunate if we had succeeded in checking the stream at an earlier point. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Slightly self-conscious in her clinging green dress and heels, Robin attracted a considerable number of appreciative glances from male passers-by as she climbed out of her taxi at the entrance to the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. As she reached the doorway, she saw approaching from 50 yards away Izzy, who was wearing bright orange, and Kinvara, in what appeared to be the slinky black dress and heavy diamond necklace that she had worn in the photograph that Robin had seen of her online. Acutely anxious about what was happening with Jimmy and Strike, Robin nevertheless registered that Kinvara appeared to be upset. Izzy rolled her eyes at Robin as they approached. Kinvara gave Robin a pointed up-and-down look that suggested she found the green dress inappropriate, if not indecent.
"We were supposed," said a booming male voice in Robin's near vicinity, "to be meeting here."
Jasper Chisel had just emerged from the building, carrying 3 engraved invitations, one of which he held out to Robin.
"Yes, I know that now, Jasper, thank you,"
said Kinvara, puffing slightly as she approached.
"Very sorry for getting it wrong again. Nobody bothered to check I knew what the arrangements were."
Passers-by stared at Chisel, finding him vaguely familiar with his chimney-brush hair. Robin saw a suited man nudge his companion and point. A sleek black Mercedes drew up at the curb. The chauffeur got out. Kinvara walked around the back of the car to sit behind him. Izzy wriggled over into the middle of the back seat, leaving Robin to take the back seat directly behind Chisel. The car pulled away from the curb, the atmosphere inside unpleasant. Robin turned her head to watch the after-work drinkers and evening shoppers, wondering whether Strike had found Knight yet, scared of what might happen when he did, and wishing she could spirit the car directly to Lancaster House.
"You haven't invited Raphael, then?"
Kinvara shot at the back of her husband's head.
"No," said Chisel. "He angled for an invitation, but that will be because he's smitten with Venetia."
Robin felt her face flood with colour.
"Venetia seems to have quite the fan base," said Kinvara tersely.
"Go and have a little chat with Raphael tomorrow," said Chisel. "I'm seeing him rather differently these days, I don't mind telling you."
Out of the corner of her eye, Robin saw Kinvara's hands twist around the chain on her ugly evening bag, which sported a horse's head picked out in crystals. A tense silence settled over the car's interior as it purred on through the warm city. Chapter 31. The result was that he got a thrashing. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Adrenaline made it easier for Strike to block out the mounting pain in his leg. He was closing on Jimmy and his companions, who were being thwarted in their desire to show themselves clearly to the press, because the excitable crowd had pressed forwards as the first official cars began to glide past, hoping to spot some celebrities. Late to the party, Core now found themselves faced by an impenetrable mass. Mercedes and Bentleys swished past, affording the crowd glimpses of the famous and the not-so-famous. A comedian got a loud cheer as he waved. A few flashes went off. Clearly deciding that he could not hope for a more prominent spot, Jimmy began to drag his homemade banner out of the tangle of legs around him, preparatory to hoisting it aloft. A woman ahead of Strike gave a shriek of indignation as he pushed her out of the way. In 3 strides, Strike had closed his large left hand around Jimmy's right wrist, preventing him from raising the placard above waist height, forcing it back towards the ground. Strike had time to see the recognition in his eyes before Jimmy's fist came hurtling at his throat. A second woman saw the punch coming and screamed. Strike dodged it and brought his left foot down hard on the placard, splintering the pole, but his amputated leg was not equal to bearing all his weight, especially as Jimmy's second punch connected. As Strike crumpled, he hit Jimmy in the balls. Knight gave a soft scream of pain, doubled up, hit the falling Strike, and both of them toppled over, knocking bystanders sideways, all of whom shouted their indignation. A strike hit the pavement. One of Jimmy's companions aimed a kick at his head. Strike caught his foot and twisted it. Through the mounting furore, he heard a third woman shriek,
"They're attacking that man!"
Strike was too intent on seizing hold of Jimmy's mangled cardboard banner to care whether he was being cast as victim or aggressor. Tugging on the banner, which, like himself, was being trampled underfoot, he succeeded in ripping it. One of the pieces attached to the spike heel of a panicking woman trying to get out of the way of the fight and was carried away. Fingers closed around his neck from behind. He aimed an elbow at Jimmy's face, and his hold loosened. But then somebody kicked Strike in the stomach, and another blow hit him on the back of the head. Red spots popped in front of his eyes. More shouting, a whistle, and the crowd was suddenly thinning around them. Strike could taste blood, but from what he could see, the splintered and torn remnants of Jimmy's placard had been scattered by the melee. Jimmy's hands were again scrabbling at Strike's neck, but then Jimmy was pulled away, swearing fluently at the top of his voice. The winded Strike was seized and dragged to his feet as well. He put up no resistance. He doubted he could have stood of his own accord. Chapter 32. "And now we can go into supper. Will you come in, Mr. Kroll?" Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Chisel's Mercedes turned the corner of St. James's Street onto Pall Mall and set off along Cleveland Row.
"What's going on?" growled Chisel, as the car slowed, then stopped.
The shouting ahead was not of the excited, enthusiastic kind that royalty or celebrities might expect. Several uniformed officers were converging on the crowd on the left-hand side of the street, which was jostling and pushing as it tried to move away from what appeared to be a confrontation between police and protesters. Two dishevelled men in jeans and T-shirts emerged from the fray, both held in arm locks by uniformed officers, Jimmy Knight and a youth with limp blonde dreadlocks. Then Robin bit back a cry of dismay as a hobbling bloody Strike appeared, also being led along by police. Behind them, an altercation in the crowd had not subsided, but was growing. A barrier swayed.
"Pull up! Pull up!"
bellowed Chisel, at the driver, who had just begun to accelerate again. Chisel wound down his window.
"Door open! Venetia, open your door! That man!"
Chisel roared at a nearby policeman, who turned, startled, to see the Minister for Culture shouting at him and pointing at Strike.
"He's my guest! That man! Bloody well let him go!"
Confronted by an official car, a government minister, the steely patrician voice, the brandishing of a thick embossed invitation, the policeman did as he was told. Most people's attention was focused on the increasingly violent brawl between police and corps, and the consequent trampling and pushing of the crowd trying to get away from it. A couple of cameramen had broken away from the press pen up ahead and were running towards the fracas.
"Izzy, move up! Get in! Get in!"
Chisel snarled at Strike through the window. Robin squeezed backwards, half sitting in Izzy's lap to accommodate Strike as he clambered into the back seat. The door slammed. The car rolled on.
"Who are you?"
squealed the frightened Kinvara, who was now pinned against the opposite door by Izzy.
"What's going on?"
"He's a private detective," growled Chisel.
His decision to bring Strike into the car seemed born of panic. Twisting around in his seat to glare at Strike, he said,
"How does it help me if you get bloody arrested?" "They weren't arresting me," said Strike, dabbing his nose with the back of his hand. "They wanted to take a statement. Knight attacked me when I went for his placard. Cheers," he added,
as, with difficulty given how tightly compressed they all were, Robin passed him a box of tissues that had been lying on the ledge behind the rear seat. He pressed one to his nose.
"I got rid of the placard,"
Strike added, through the blood-stained tissue, but nobody congratulated him.
"Jasper," said Kinvara, "what's going—"
"Shut up," snapped Chisel, without looking at her. "I can't let you out in front of all these people," he told Strike angrily, as though the latter had suggested it. "There are more photographers. You'll have to come in with us. I'll fix it."
The car was now proceeding towards a barrier where police and security were checking ID and investigations.
"Nobody say anything," Chisel instructed. "Shut up," he added preemptively to Kinvara, who had opened her mouth.
A Bentley up ahead was admitted, and the Mercedes rolled forwards. In pain because she was bearing a good proportion of Strike's weight across her left hip and leg, Robin heard screeching from behind the car. Turning, she saw a young woman running after the car, a female police officer chasing her. The girl had wild tomato red hair, a T-shirt with a logo of broken Olympic rings on it, and she screamed after Chisel's car.
"He put the fucking horse on them! Chisel! He put the horse on them! You cheating, thieving bastard! You murderer!"
"I have a guest here who didn't get his invitation," Chisel was shouting through his wound-down window to the armed policeman at the barrier. "Cormoran Strike, the amputee. He's been in the papers. There was a balls up at my department. His invitation didn't go. The prince," he said with breathtaking chutzpah, "asked to meet him specifically."
Strike and Robin were watching what was happening behind the car. Two policemen had seized the struggling flick and were escorting her away. A few more cameras flashed. Caving under the weight of ministerial pressure, the armed policeman requested ID of Strike. Strike, who always carried a couple of forms of identification, though not necessarily in his own name, passed over his genuine driving license. A queue of stationary cars grew longer behind them. The prince was due in 15 minutes' time. Finally, the policeman waved them through.
"Shouldn't have done that," said Strike in an undertone to Robin. "Shouldn't have let me in, bloody lax."
The Mercedes swung around the inner courtyard and arrived, finally, at the foot of a shallow flight of red-carpeted steps, in front of an enormous, honey-coloured building that resembled a stately home. Wheelchair ramps had been set either side of the carpet, and a celebrated wheelchair basketball player was already manoeuvring his way up one. Strike pushed open the door, clambered out of the car, then turned and reached back inside to assist Robin. She accepted the offer of help. Her left leg was almost completely numb from where he'd sat on her.
"Nice to see you again, Corm,"
said Izzy, beaming, as she got out behind Robin.
"Hi, Izzy," said Strike.
Now burdened with Strike whether he wanted him or not, Chisel hurried up the steps to explain to one of the liveried men standing outside the front door that Strike must be admitted without his invitation. They heard a recurrence of the word amputee. All around them, more cars were releasing their smartly dressed passengers.
"What's all this about?"
Kinvara said, who had marched around the rear of the Mercedes to address Strike.
"What's going on? What does my husband need a private detective for?"
"Will you be quiet, you stupid, stupid bitch?"
Stressed and disturbed though Chisel undoubtedly was, his naked hostility shocked Robin.
"He hates her," she thought. "He genuinely hates her."
"You two," said the minister, pointing at his wife and daughter. "Get inside." "Give me one good reason I should keep paying you," he added, turning on Strike as still more people spilled past them. "You realize," said Chisel, and in his necessarily quiet fury, spit flew from his mouth onto Strike's tie. "I've just been called a bloody murderer in front of 20 people, including press." "They'll think she's a crank," said Strike.
If the suggestion brought Chisel any comfort, it didn't show.
"I want to see you tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, he told Strike. "Not at my office. Come to the flat in Ebury Street."
He turned away, then, as an afterthought, turned back.
"You too," he barked at Robin.
Side by side, they watched him lumbering up the steps.
"We're about to get sacked, aren't we?" whispered Robin.
"I'd say it's odds on," said Strike,
who, now that he was on his feet, was in considerable pain.
"Cormoran, what was on the placard?" said Robin.
Strike allowed a woman in peach chiffon to pass, then said quietly,
"Picture of Chisel hanging from a gallows and beneath him a bunch of dead children. One odd thing, though."
"What?"
"All the kids were black."
Still dabbing at his nose, Strike reached inside his pocket for a cigarette, then remembered where he was, and let his hand fall back to his side.
"Listen, if that Elspeth woman's in here, you might as well try to find out what else she knows about Wynne. It'll help justify our final invoice."
"Okay," said Robin. "The back of your head's bleeding, by the way." Strike dabbed at it ineffectually with the tissues he had pocketed, and began to limp up the steps beside Robin.
"We shouldn't be seen together any more tonight," he told her, as they passed over the threshold into a blaze of ochre, scarlet and gold. "There was a cafe in Ebury Street, not far from Chisel's house. I'll meet you there at 9 o'clock tomorrow, and we can face the firing squad together. Go on. You go ahead."
But as she moved away from him towards the grand staircase, he called after her.
"Nice dress, by the way."
Chapter 33 "I believe you could bewitch anyone, if you set yourself to do it." Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The grand hallway of the mansion constituted a vast empty block of space. A red and gold carpeted central staircase led to an upper balcony that split left and right. The walls, which appeared to be of marble, were ochre, dull green, and rose. Sundry Paralympians were being shown to a lift on the left of the entrance, but the limping Strike made his way laboriously to the stairs and heaved himself upwards by liberal use of the banister. The sky, visible through a huge and ornate skylight supported by columns, was fading through technicolor variations that intensified the colors of the massive Venetian paintings of classical subjects hanging on every wall. Doing his best to walk naturally, because he was afraid he might be mistaken for some veteran Paralympian, and perhaps asked to expound on past triumphs, Strike followed the crowd up the right staircase, around the balcony, and into a small anteroom overlooking the courtyard where the official cars were parked. From here, the guests were ushered left into a long and spacious picture gallery, where the carpet was apple green and decorated with a rosette pattern. Tall windows stood at either end of the room, and almost every inch of white wall was covered in paintings.
"Drink, sir," said a waiter just inside the doorway.
"Is it champagne?" asked Strike.
"English sparkling wine, sir," said the waiter.
Strike helped himself, though without enthusiasm, and continued through the crowd, passing Chisel and Kinvara, who were listening, or, Strike thought, pretending to listen, to a wheelchair-bound athlete. Kinvara shot Strike a swift, suspicious side glance as he passed, aiming for the far wall, where he hoped to find either a chair or something on which he could conveniently lean. Unfortunately, the gallery walls were so densely packed with pictures that leaning was impossible, nor were there any seats, so Strike came to rest beside an enormous painting by Count d'Orsay of Queen Victoria riding a dapple grey horse. While he sipped his sparkling wine, he tried discreetly to staunch the blood still leaking from his nose and wipe the worst of the dirt off his suit trousers. Waiters were circulating, carrying trays of canapés. Strike managed to grab a couple of miniature crab cakes as they passed, then fell to examining his surroundings, noting another spectacular skylight, this one supported by a number of gilded palm trees. The room had a peculiar energy. The prince's arrival was imminent, and the guests' gaiety came and went in nervous spurts, with increasingly frequent glances at the doors. From his vantage point beside Queen Victoria, Strike spotted a stately figure in a primrose-yellow dress, standing almost directly opposite him, close beside an ornate black-and-gold fireplace. One hand was keeping a gentle hold on the harness of a pale-yellow Labrador, who sat panting gently at her feet in the overcrowded room. Strike had not immediately recognized Della, because she was not wearing sunglasses, but prosthetic eyes. Her slightly sunken, opaque china-blue gaze gave her an odd innocence. Geraint stood a short distance from his wife, gabbling at a thin, mousy woman whose eyes darted around, searching for a rescuer. A sudden hush fell near the doors through which Strike had entered. Strike saw the top of a ginger head and a flurry of suits. Self-consciousness spread through the packed room like a petrifying breeze. Strike watched the top of the ginger head move away towards the far right side of the room. Still sipping his English wine, and wondering which of the women in the room was the trustee with dirt on Geraint Wynne, his attention was suddenly caught by a tall woman nearby, with her back to him. Her long dark hair was twisted up into a messy bun, and unlike every other woman present, her outfit gave no suggestion of party best. The straight black knee-length dress was plain to the point of severity, and though bare-legged, she wore a pair of spike-heeled, open-toed ankle boots. For a sliver of a second, Strike thought he must be mistaken, but then she moved, and he knew for sure that it was her. Before he could move away from her vicinity, she turned around and looked straight into his eyes. Colour flooded her face, which, as he knew, was normally cameo pale. She was heavily pregnant. Her condition had not touched her anywhere but the swollen belly. She was as fine-boned as ever in face and limbs. Less adorned than any other woman in the room, she was easily the most beautiful. For a few seconds they contemplated each other. Then she took a few tentative steps forwards, the colour ebbing from her cheeks as fast as it had come.
"Corm?"
"Hello, Charlotte."
If she thought of kissing him, his stony face deterred her.
"What on earth are you doing here?"
"Invited, Lightstrike. Celebrity amputee. You?"
She seemed dazed. "Jago's niece is a Paralympian. She's..." Charlotte looked around, apparently trying to spot the niece, and took a sip of water. Her hand was shaking. A few drops spilled from the glass. He saw them break like glass beads on her swollen belly.
"Well, she's here somewhere," she said, with a nervous laugh. "She's got cerebral palsy, and she's remarkable, actually, an incredible rider. Her father's in Hong Kong, so her mum invited me instead."
His silence was unnerving her. She rattled on.
"Jago's family like to make me go out and do things, only my sister-in-law's cross because I got the dates mixed up. I thought tonight was dinner at the Shard, and this thing was Friday, tomorrow, I mean, so I'm not properly dressed for royalty. But I was late, and I didn't have time to change."
She gestured hopelessly at her plain black dress and her spike-heeled boots.
"Jago not here."
Her gold-flecked green eyes flickered slightly.
"No, he's in the States."
Her focus moved to his upper lip.
"Have you been in a fight?"
"No,"
he said, dabbing at his nose with the back of his hand again. He straightened up, lowering his weight carefully back onto his prosthesis, ready to walk away.
"Well, nice to—"
"Come, don't go,"
she said, reaching out. Her fingers did not quite make contact with his sleeve. She let her hand fall back by her side.
"Don't, not yet, I—" "You've done such incredible things. I read about them all in the papers."
The last time they had seen each other he had been bleeding too, because of the flying ashtray that had caught him in the face as he left her. He remembered the text. "It was yours," sent on the eve of her wedding to Ross, referring to another baby she had claimed to be bearing, which had vanished before he ever saw proof of its existence. He remembered, too, the picture she had sent to his office of herself minutes after saying, "I do," to Jago Ross, beautiful and stricken, like a sacrificial victim.
"Congratulations," he said, keeping his eyes on her face.
"I'm huge because it's twins."
She did not, as he had seen other pregnant women do, touch her belly as she talked about the babies, but looked down as though slightly surprised to see her changed shape. She had never wanted children when they had been together. It was one of the things they had had in common. The baby that she had claimed was his had been an unwelcome surprise to both of them. In Strike's imagination, Jago Ross's progeny were curled under the black dress like a pair of white whelps, not entirely human, emissaries of their father, who resembled a dissolute Arctic fox. He was glad they were there, if such a joyless emotion could be called gladness. All impediments, all deterrents were welcome, because it now became apparent to him that the gravitational pull Charlotte had so long exerted over him, even after hundreds of fights and scenes and 1,000 lives, was not yet spent. As ever, he had the sense that behind the green and gold-flecked eyes, she knew exactly what he was thinking.
"They aren't due for ages. I had a scan. It's a boy and a girl. Jago's pleased about the boy. Are you here with anyone?"
"No."
As he said it, he caught a flash of green over Charlotte's shoulder. Robin, who was now talking brightly to the mousy woman in purple brocade, who had finally escaped Geraint.
"Pretty," said Charlotte, who had looked to see what had caught his attention. She had always had a preternatural ability to detect the slightest flicker of interest towards other women.
"No, wait," she said slowly. "Isn't that the girl who works with you? She was in all the papers. What's her name? Rob?"
"No," said Strike. "That's not her."
He wasn't remotely surprised that Charlotte knew Robin's name, or that she had recognized her, even with the hazel contact lenses. He had known Charlotte would keep tabs on him.
"You've always liked girls with that colouring, haven't you?" said Charlotte, with a kind of synthetic gaiety. "That little American you started dating after you pretended we'd broken up in Germany had the same kind of..."
There was a kind of hushed scream in their vicinity.
"Oh, my God! Charlie!"
Izzy Chisel was bearing down upon them, beaming, her pink face clashing with her orange dress. She was, Strike suspected, not on her first glass of wine.
"Hello, Iz," said Charlotte, forcing a smile.
Strike could almost feel the effort it cost her to tuck herself free of that tangle of ancient grudges and wounds in which their relationship had gradually strangled to death. Again, he prepared to walk away, but the crowd parted, and Prince Harry was suddenly revealed in all his hyper-real familiarity, some 10 feet away from where Strike and the two women stood, so that moving away from the area would be done under the scrutiny of half the room. Trapped, Strike startled a passing waiter by reaching out a long arm and snatching another glass of wine from his tray. For a few seconds, both Charlotte and Izzy watched the prince. Then, when it became apparent that he was not about to approach them any time soon, they turned back to each other.
"Showing already," Izzy said, admiring Charlotte's belly. "Have you had a scan? Do you know what it is?"
"Twins," said Charlotte, without enthusiasm.
She indicated Strike. "You remember..."
"Corm, yeah, of course, we brought him here," said Izzy,
beaming and clearly unconscious of any indiscretion. Charlotte turned from her old school friend to her ex, and Strike could feel her sniffing the air for the reason that Strike and Izzy would have travelled together. She shifted very slightly, apparently allowing Izzy into the conversation, but boxing Strike in so that he couldn't walk away without asking one of them to get out of his way.
"Oh, wait, of course. You investigated Freddy's death in action, didn't you?" she said. "I remember you telling me about it. Poor Freddy."
Izzy acknowledged this tribute to her brother with a slight tip of her glass, then peeked back over her shoulder at Prince Harry.
"He gets sexier every passing day, doesn't he?" she whispered.
"Ginger pubes there, darling," said Charlotte, deadpan.
Against his will, Strike grinned. Izzy snorted with laughter. "Speaking of which," said Charlotte. She never acknowledged that she had been funny.
"Isn't that Kinvara Hanratty over there?"
"My ghastly stepmother, yes," said Izzy.
"Do you know her?"
"My sister sold her a horse."
During the 16 years of Strike's on-off relationship with Charlotte, he had been privy to countless conversations like this. People of Charlotte's class all seemed to know each other. Even if they had never met, they knew siblings or cousins or friends or classmates, or else their parents knew somebody else's parents. All were connected, forming a kind of web that constituted a hostile habitat for outsiders. Rarely did these web-dwellers leave to seek companionship or love among the rest of society. Charlotte had been unique in her circle in choosing somebody as unclassifiable as Strike, whose invisible appeal and low status had, he knew, been subjects of perennial, horrified debate among most of her friends and family.
"Well, I hope it wasn't a horse Amelia liked," Izzy said, "because Kinvara will ruin it. Awful hands and a horrible seat, but she thinks she's Charlotte Dujardin. Do you ride, Cormorant?" Izzy asked.
"No," said Strike.
"He doesn't trust horses," said Charlotte, smiling at him. But he did not respond. He had no desire to touch upon old jokes or shared memories.
"Kinvara's livid. Look at her," said Izzy, with some satisfaction. "Papa's just dropped a heavy hint he's going to try and talk my brother Raff into taking over from me, which is fabulous, and what I hoped would happen. Papa used to let Kinvara boss him around about Raff, but he's putting his foot down these days."
"I think I've met Raphael," said Charlotte. "Wasn't he working at Henry Drummond's art gallery a couple of months ago?" Strike checked at his watch and then back around the room. The prince was moving away from their part of the room, and Robin was nowhere to be seen. With any luck, she had followed the trustee who had dirt on Wynne into the bathroom and was eliciting confidences over the sink.
"Oh, Lord," said Izzy. "Look out! Geraint bloody... Hello, Geraint!"
Geraint's object, it soon became clear, was Charlotte.
"Hello, hello," he said,
peering at her through heavily smudged glasses, his lipless smile a leer.
"You've just been pointed out to me by your niece. What an extraordinary young woman she is, quite extraordinary. Our charity's involved in supporting the equestrian team." "Geraint Wynne," he said, holding out a hand. "The level playing field."
"Oh," said Charlotte. "Hello." Strike had watched her repel lecherous men for years. Having acknowledged his presence, she stared coldly at Geraint, as though quite puzzled to know why he was still in her vicinity. Strike's mobile vibrated in his pocket. Reaching for it, he saw an unknown number. This was his excuse to leave.
"Need to get going. Sorry. Excuse me, Izzy."
"Oh, that's a shame," Izzy said, pouting. "I wanted to ask you all about the Shacklewell Ripper."
Strike saw Geraint's eyes widen. Inwardly cursing her, he said,
"Night."
"Bye," he said to Charlotte. Limping away as fast as he could manage, he accepted the call, but by the time he had raised it to his ear, the caller had gone.
"Corm?"
Somebody lightly touched his arm. He turned. Charlotte had followed him. "I'm leaving too."
"What about your niece?"
"She's met Harry, she'll be thrilled. She doesn't actually like me that much, none of them do."
"What happened to your mobile?"
"I fell on it."
He walked on, but long-legged as she was, she caught up with him.
"I don't think I'm going your way, Charlotte."
"Well, unless you're tunneling out, we have to walk 200 yards together." He limped on without answering. To his left, he caught another flash of green. As they reached the grand staircase in the hall, Charlotte reached out and lightly grasped his arm, wobbly in the heels that were so unsuitable for a pregnant woman. He resisted the urge to shake her loose. His mobile rang again. The same unknown number had appeared on the screen. Charlotte drew up beside him, watching his face as he answered it. The moment the mobile touched his ear, he heard a desperate, haunting scream.
"They're going to kill me, Mr. Strike! Help me! Help me! Please help me!"
Chapter 34. But who could really foresee what was coming? I am sure I could not. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The hazy, clear-skied promise of another summer's day hadn't yet translated itself into actual warmth when Robin arrived next morning at the café closest to Chisel's house. She could have chosen one of the circular tables outside on the pavement, but instead she huddled down in a corner of the café where she was to meet Strike, hands clasped around her latte for comfort, a reflection in the espresso machine, pale and heavy-eyed. Somehow, she had known that Strike would not be here when she arrived. Her mood was simultaneously depressed and nervy. She would rather not have been alone with her thoughts. But here she was, with only the hiss of the coffee-maker for company, chilly, in spite of the jacket she had grabbed on the way out of the house, and full of anxiety about the imminent confrontation with Chisel, who might quibble his bill after the catastrophe of Strike's fight with Jimmy Knight. But that wasn't all that was worrying Robin. She had woken that morning from a confused dream in which the dark, spike-booted figure of Charlotte Ross figured. Robin had recognized Charlotte immediately when she spotted her at the reception. She had tried not to watch the once-engaged couple as they talked, angry with herself for being so sharply interested in what was passing between them, yet even as she had moved from group to group, shamelessly insinuating herself into conversations in the hope of finding the elusive Elspeth Curtis Lacey, her eyes had sought out Strike and Charlotte, and when they left the reception together, she had experienced a nasty sensation in her stomach, akin to the drop of an elevator. She had arrived home unable to think of anything else, which made her feel guilty when Matthew emerged from the kitchen eating a sandwich. She had the impression that he had not been home long. He subjected the green dress to an up-and-down look, very like the one Kinvara had given her. She made to walk past him upstairs, but he had moved to block her. "Robin, come on, please. Let's talk." So they had gone into the sitting room and talked. Tired of conflict, she had apologized for hurting Matthew's feelings by missing the cricket match, and for forgetting her wedding ring on their anniversary weekend. Matthew, in turn, had expressed regret for the things he had said during Sunday's row, and especially for the remark about her lack of achievements. Robin felt as though they were moving chess pieces on a board that was vibrating in the preliminary tremors of an earthquake. "It's too late. You know, surely, that none of this matters any more." But when the talk was finished, Matthew said, "So we're okay?"
"Yes,"
she replied.
"We're fine."
He had stood up, held out a hand, and helped her up from her chair. She had forced a smile, and then he had kissed her, hard, on the mouth, and begun to tug at the green dress. She heard the fabric around the zip tear, and when she began to protest, he clamped his mouth on hers again. She knew that she could stop him. She knew that he was waiting for her to stop him, that she was being tested in an ugly, underhand way, that he would deny what he was really doing, that he would claim to be the victim. She hated him for doing it this way, and part of her wanted to be the kind of woman who could have disengaged from her own revulsion and from her own reluctant flesh. But she had fought too long and too hard to regain possession of her own body to barter it in this way. "No," she said, pushing him away. "I don't want to." He released her at once, as she had known he would, with an expression compounded of anger and triumph. Suddenly, she knew that she had not fooled him when they had had sex on their anniversary weekend, and paradoxically, that made her feel tender towards him.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm tired."
"Yeah," said Matthew. "So am I." And he had walked out of the room, leaving Robin with a chill down her back where the green dress had torn. Where the hell was Strike? It was 9:05 and she wanted company. She also wanted to know what had happened after he left the reception with Charlotte. Anything would be preferable to sitting here, thinking about Matthew. As though the thought had summoned him, her phone rang. "Sorry," he said before she could speak. "Suspicious package at Bloody Green Park. I've been stuck on the tube for 20 minutes and I've only just got reception. I'll be there as quick as I can, but you might have to start without me."
"Oh, God," said Robin, closing her tired eyes.
"Sorry," Strike repeated. "I'm on my way. Got something to tell you, actually. Funny thing happened last night. Oh, hang on, we're moving. See you shortly." He hung up, leaving Robin with the prospect of having to deal alone with the first effusions of Jasper Chisel's anger, and still grappling formless feelings of dread and misery that swirled around a dark, graceful woman who was 16 years' worth of knowledge and memories ahead of her when it came to Cormoran and Strike, which, Robin told herself, shouldn't matter for God's sake. Haven't you got enough problems without worrying about Strike's love life? It's nothing whatsoever to do with you. She felt a sudden guilty prickle around her lips, where Strike's missed kiss had landed outside the hospital. As though she could wash it away, she downed the dregs of her coffee, got up and left the cafe for the broad, straight street, which comprised two symmetrical lines of identical 19th-century houses. She walked briskly, not because she was in any hurry to bear the brunt of Chisel's anger and disappointment, but because activity helped dispel her uncomfortable thoughts. Arriving outside Chisel's house precisely on time, she lingered for a few hopeful seconds beside the glossy black front door, just in case Strike were to appear at the last moment. He didn't. Robin therefore steadied herself, walked up the three clean white steps from the pavement, and knocked on the front door, which was on the latch and opened a few inches. A man's muffled voice shouted something that might have been "come in." Robin passed into a small dingy hall, dominated by vertiginous stairs. The olive-green wallpaper was drab and peeling in places. Leaving the front door as she had found it, she called out, "Minister?" He didn't answer. Robin knocked gently on the door to the right and opened it. Time froze. The scene seemed to fold in upon her, crashing through her retinas into a mind unprepared for it, and shock kept her standing in the doorway, her hand still on the handle and her mouth slightly open, trying to comprehend what she was seeing. A man was sitting in a Queen Anne chair, his legs splayed, his arms dangling, and he seemed to have a shiny grey turnip for a head, in which a carved mouth gaped, but no eyes. Then Robin's struggling comprehension grasped the fact that it was not a turnip, but a human head, shrink-wrapped in a clear plastic bag, into which a tube ran from a large canister. The man looked as though he had suffocated. His left foot lay sideways on the rug, revealing a small hole in the sole. His thick fingers dangled, almost touching the carpet, and there was a stain at his groin where his bladder had emptied. And next she understood that it was Chisel himself who sat in the chair, and that his thick mass of grey hair was pressed flat against his face in the vacuum created by the bag, and that the gaping mouth had sucked the plastic into itself, which was why it gaped so darkly. Chapter 35. The White Horse, in broad daylight. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Somewhere in the distance outside the house, a man shouted. He sounded like a workman, and in some part of her brain, Robin knew that that was who she had heard when she was expecting to hear, "Come in." Nobody had invited her into the house. The door had simply been left ajar. Now, when it might have been expected, she didn't panic. There was no threat here, however horrifying the sight of that awful dummy with the turnip head and the tube. This poor, lifeless figure could not hurt her. Knowing that she must check that life was extinct, Robin approached Chisel and gently touched his shoulder. It was easier, not being able to see his eyes, because of the coarse hair that obscured them like a horse's forelock. The flesh felt hard beneath his striped shirt, and cooler than she had expected. But then she imagined the gaping mouth speaking, and took several quick steps backwards, until her foot landed with a crunch on something hard on the carpet, and she slipped. She had cracked a pale blue plastic tube of pills lying on the carpet. She recognized them as the sort of homeopathic tablets sold in her local chemist. Taking out her mobile, she called 999 and asked for the police. After explaining that she had found a body and giving the address, she was told that someone would be with her shortly. Trying not to focus on Chisel, she took in the frayed curtains, which were of an indeterminate dun colour, trimmed with sad little baubles, the antiquated TV in its faux wood cladding, the patch of darker wallpaper over the mantelpiece where a painting had once hung, and the silver-framed photographs. But the shrink-wrapped head, the rubber piping, and the cold glint of the canister seemed to turn all of this everyday normality into pasteboard. The nightmare alone was real. So Robin turned her mobile onto its camera function and began to take photographs. Putting a lens between herself and the scene mitigated the horror. Slowly and methodically, she documented the scene. A glass sat on the coffee table in front of the body, with a few millimeters of what looked like orange juice in it. Scattered books and papers lay beside it. There was a piece of thick cream writing paper headed with a red Tudor rose, like a drop of blood, and the printed address of the house in which Robin stood. Somebody had written in a rounded, girlish hand. "Tonight was the final straw. How stupid do you think I am, putting that girl in your office right under my nose? I hope you realize how ridiculous you look, how much people are laughing at you, chasing a girl who's younger than your daughters. I've had enough. Make a fool of yourself, I don't care anymore, it's over. I've gone back to Woolston. Once I've made arrangements for the horses, I'll clear out for good. Your bloody horrible children will be happy, but will you, Jasper? I doubt it, but it's too late. K." As Robin bent to take a picture of the note, she heard the front door snap shut, and with a gasp, she spun around. Strike was standing on the threshold, large, unshaven, still in the suit he had worn to the reception. He was staring at the figure in the chair. "The police are on their way," said Robin. "I just called them." Strike moved carefully into the room.
"Holy shit."
He spotted the cracked tube of pills on the floor, stepped over them, and scrutinized the tubing and the plastic-covered face. "Raff said he was behaving strangely," said Robin. "But I don't think he ever dreamed..." Strike said nothing. He was still examining the body.
"Was that there yesterday evening?"
"What?"
"That," said Strike, pointing.
There was a semicircular mark on the back of Chisel's hand, dark red against the coarse, pallid skin. "I can't remember," said Robin. The full shock of what had happened was starting to hit her, and she was finding it hard to arrange her thoughts, which floated, unmoored and disconnected, through her head. Chisel barking through the car window to persuade the police to let Strike into last night's reception. Chisel calling Kinvara a stupid bitch. Chisel demanding that they meet him here this morning. It was unreasonable to expect her to remember the back of his hands.
"Hmm,"
said Strike. He noticed the mobile in Robin's hand.
"Have you taken pictures of everything?"
She nodded.
"All of this?" he asked, waving a hand over the table. "That?" he added, pointing at the cracked pills on the carpet.
"Yes, that was my fault. I trod on them."
"How did you get in?"
"The door was open. I thought he'd left it on the latch for us," said Robin. "A workman shouted in the street, and I thought it was Chisel saying, 'Come in.' I was expecting—"
"Stay here," said Strike.
He left the room. She heard him climbing the stairs, and then his heavy footsteps on the ceiling above. But she knew that there was nobody there. She could feel the house's essential lifelessness, its flimsy cardboard unreality. And sure enough, Strike returned less than 5 minutes later, shaking his head.
"Nobody."
He walked past her through a door that led off the sitting room, and hearing footsteps hit tile, Robin knew that it was the kitchen.
"Completely empty," Strike said, re-emerging.
"What happened last night?" Robin asked. "You said something funny happened." She wanted to discuss a subject other than the awful form that dominated the room in its grotesque lifelessness.
"Billy called me. He said people were trying to kill him, chasing him. He claimed to be in a phone box in Trafalgar Square. I went to try and find him, but he wasn't there."
"Oh," said Robin. So he hadn't been with Charlotte. Even in this extremity, Robin registered the fact and was glad.
"The hell?"
said Strike quietly, looking past her into a corner of the room. A buckled sword was leaning against the wall in a dark corner. It looked as though it had been forced or stood on and deliberately bent. Strike walked carefully around the body to examine it, but then they heard the police car pulling up outside the house, and he straightened up.
"We'll tell them everything, obviously," said Strike.
"Yes," said Robin.
"Except the surveillance devices. Shit, they'll find them in your office."
"They won't," said Robin. "I took them home yesterday, in case we decided I needed to clear out because of the sun." Before Strike could express admiration for this clear-eyed foresight, somebody rapped hard on the front door.
"Well, it's been nice while it's lasted, hasn't it?" Strike said, with a grim smile, as he moved towards the hall. "Being out of the papers."
Part 2 Chapter 36 What has happened can be hushed up, or at any rate can be explained away. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The Chisel case maintained its singular character even when their client was no more. As the usual cumbersome procedures and formalities enveloped the corpse, Strike and Robin were escorted from Ebury Street to Scotland Yard, where they were separately interviewed. Strike knew that a tornado of speculation must be whirling through the newsrooms of London at the death of a government minister, and sure enough, by the time they emerged from Scotland Yard 6 hours later, the colourful details of Chisel's private life were being broadcast across TV and radio, while opening the internet browsers on their phones revealed brief news items from news sites as a tangle of baroque theories spread across blogs and social media, in which a multitude of cartoonish Chisels died at the hand of myriad nebulous foes. As he rode in a taxi back to Denmark Street, Strike read how Chisel, the corrupt capitalist, had been murdered by the Russian mafia after failing to pay back interest on some seedy illegal transaction, while Chisel, the defender of solid English values, had surely been dispatched by vengeful Islamists after his attempts to resist the rise of Sharia law. Strike returned to his attic flat only to collect his belongings and decamped to the house of his old friends Nick and Ilse, respectively a gastroenterologist and a lawyer. Robin, who at Strike's insistence had taken a taxi directly home to Albury Street, was given a peremptory hug by Matthew, whose tissue-thin pretense of sympathy was worse, Robin felt, than outright fury. When he heard that Robin had been summoned back to Scotland Yard for further interrogation the next day, Matthew's self-control crumbled.
"Anyone could have seen this coming."
"Funny, it seemed to take most people by surprise," Robin said. She had just ignored her mother's fourth call of the morning.
"I don't mean Chiswell killing himself."
"It's pronounced Chisel.
I mean you getting yourself into trouble for sneaking around the Houses of Parliament."
"Don't worry, Matt, I'll make sure the police know you were against it. Wouldn't want your promotion prospects compromised." But she wasn't sure that her second interviewer was a policeman. The softly spoken man in a dark grey suit didn't reveal whom he worked for. Robin found this gentleman far more intimidating than yesterday's police, even though they had, at times, been forceful to the point of aggression. Robin told her new interviewer everything she had seen and heard in the Commons, omitting only the strange conversation between Della Wynne and Amir Malik, which had been captured on a second listening device. As the interaction had taken place behind a closed door after normal working hours, she could only have heard it by using surveillance equipment. Robin assuaged her conscience by telling herself that this conversation could not possibly have anything to do with Chisel's death, but squirming feelings of guilt and terror pursued her as she left the building for the second time. So consumed was she by what she hoped was paranoia by this brush with the security services that she called Strike from a payphone near the tube instead of using her mobile. "I've just had another interview. I'm pretty sure it was MI5.
"Bound to happen," said Strike, and she took solace from his matter-of-fact tone. "They've got to check you out. Make sure you are who you claim to be. Isn't there anywhere you can go other than home? I can't believe the press aren't on to us yet, but it must be imminent."
"I could go back to Masham, I suppose," Robin said. "But they're bound to try there if they want to find me. That's where they came after the Ripper stuff."
Unlike Strike,
She had no friends of her own into whose anonymous homes she felt she could vanish. All her friends were Matthews, too, and she had no doubt that, like her husband, they would be scared of harbouring anybody who was of interest to the security services. At a loss as to what to do, she went back to Albury Street. Yet the press didn't come for her, even though the newspapers were hardly holding back on the subject of Chisel. The Mail had already run a double-page spread on the various tribulations and scandals that had plagued Jasper Chisel's life. Once mentioned as a possible prime minister, sexy Italian Ornella Serafin, with whom he had the affair that broke up his first marriage, voluptuous Kinvara Hanratty, who was 30 years his junior, Lieutenant Freddie Chiswell, eldest son, died in the Iraq War his father had staunchly supported, youngest child Raphael, whose drug-filled joyride ended in the death of a young mother. Broadsheets contained tributes from friends and colleagues. A fine mind, a supremely able minister, one of Thatcher's bright young men. But for a somewhat tumultuous private life, there were no heights he might not have reached. The public persona was irascible, even abrasive, but the Jasper Chisel I knew at Harrow was a witty and intelligent boy. 5 days of lurid press coverage passed, yet still the press's mysterious restraint on the subject of Strike and Robin's involvement held, and still nobody had printed a word about blackmail. On the Friday morning following the discovery of Chisel's body, Strike was sitting quietly at Nick and Ilse's kitchen table, sunlight pouring through the window behind him. His host and hostess were at work. Nick and Ilse, who had been trying for some years to have a baby, had recently adopted a pair of kittens, whom Nick had insisted on calling Ozzy and Ricky, after the two Spurs players he had revered in his teens. The cats, who had only recently consented to sit on the knees of their adoptive parents, had not appreciated the arrival of the large and unfamiliar Strike. Finding themselves alone with him, they had sought refuge on top of a kitchen wall cabinet. He was currently conscious of the scrutiny of 4 pale green eyes, which followed his every movement from on high. Not that he was currently moving a great deal. Indeed, for much of the past half an hour he had been almost motionless, as he pored over the photographs that Robin had taken in Ebury Street, which he had printed out in Nick's study for convenience. Finally, causing Ricky to jump up in a flurry of upended fur, Strike isolated 9 of the photographs and put the rest in a pile. While Strike scrutinized his selected images, Ricky settled back down, the tip of a black tail swaying as he awaited the detective's next move. The first photograph that Strike had selected showed a close-up of the small semicircular puncture mark on Chisel's left hand. The second and third pictures showed different angles of the glass that had sat on the coffee table in front of Chisel. A powdery residue was visible on the sides, above an inch of orange juice. The 4th, 5th and 6th photographs Strike laid together side by side. Each showed a slightly different angle of the body, with slices of the surrounding room caught within its frame. Once again, Strike studied the ghostly outline of the buckled sword in the corner, the dark patch over the mantelpiece where a picture had previously hung, and beneath this, barely noticeable against the dark wallpaper, a pair of brass hooks spaced nearly a yard apart. The 7th and 8th photographs, when placed side by side, showed the entirety of the coffee table. Kinvara's farewell letter sat on top of a number of papers and books, of which only a sliver of one letter was visible, signed by Brenda Bailey. Of the books, Strike could see nothing but a partial title on an old cloth edition, Catull, and the lower part of a Penguin paperback. Also in shot was the upturned corner of the threadbare rug beneath the table. The 9th and final picture, which Strike had enlarged from yet another shot of the body, showed Chisel's gaping trouser pocket, in which something shiny and golden had been caught in the flash of Robin's camera. While he was still contemplating this gleaming object, Strike's mobile rang. It was his hostess, Ilse.
"Hi," he said.
standing up and grabbing the packet of Benson and Hedges and lighter that lay on the side behind him. With an eruption of claws on wood, Ozzie and Ricky streaked along the top of the kitchen cabinets in case Strike was about to start throwing things at them. Checking to see that they were too far away to make a break for the garden,